go.
Sniper arrow on the guard.
It strikes true, the guard drops.
I move to the doorway, detect traps.
None detected.
I enter.
Left flank.
Right!
One hobgoblin facing east.
Backstab.
Double damage. Critical hit, he's dead. Footsteps behind the door to the north.
I notch two arrows.
I climb the walls to get above the door.
Five goblins enter from the north.
I fire.
Both arrows hit.
Cleave!
You kill one and wound another.
I drop on the last one and grapple.
You got hold of him.
This one is for Crouton.
With his dying breath, he utters,
"The Dark Lord will kill you all."
Wait, these things can talk? I want two taken alive. I want to try something.
This is Siskoid hosting another episode of Let's Roll, the show where we discuss various role-playing games with guests and fellow tabletop gamers. And this episode continues our discussion of Shift World, our GURPS-fueled campaign that tries to use as many source books and settings as possible. We've already talked about, let's enumerate them, Old West, Auto Duel, Mars, Ice Age, Mecha, Steampunk, Vikings, and Time Travel. And today we're talking about GURPS Greece and GURPS Space, which may seem like a weird combo, but let's call it mythic role-playing, as our version of the space RPG was mostly beholden to Star Wars. So we'll talk a little bit about that setting as well. To do this, I've invited the two players who experienced it, Daniel Poutouellet.
Hello, everyone.
And Alexandre Bert Hébert. Hi, guys.
Greetings.
So just to recap, maybe some listeners are coming into this cold because they're interested in these particular settings. Let's talk a little bit about Shift World. Basically, we had these originally three brothers who lived in the Old West and everything was fine. They had happy adventures. And then suddenly the world shifted around them. And not only was it a different world, a different GURPS setting, but they had memories of that world superimposed on their former memories, I guess, the original memories. And it shifted that way every few sessions until they'd lived the same life in different versions in all of these different settings.
The only thing I would question is, are you sure everything was so good in Old West?
Yeah, probably not. But in any case, there was a fourth player added when Bert here had to leave for other climbs. His character also did so. And so we brought in an orphan called 12, who's played by somebody else. Probably you can go back and listen to all the different GURPS iterations of this on other episodes of Let's Roll. These ones are important because they are basically when we return to the game after between 15 and 20 years. And it was all due to this show, really, because the first time we talked about the Shift World stuff, it was between us three, and it ended up reviving the flame.
Indeed. I missed this. It was fun because my brother found me back, and that was the way to bring me back to the story. And so now I'm back, and here's what happens.
And I was just tired of sitting alone at a table pretending all my friends were with me and inventing what Shift World would have been. So I was glad to come back to it.
That was like a couple years ago now. Unfortunately, we couldn't bring in the other two guys. They were always too busy, or, you know, there was some interest. It never quite happened. So it became just the two players and the one GM. We found a way to make it work.
Well, mostly you found a way to make it work.
Well, that's my job, right? That's the GM. That was my job.
It was interesting to see how the dynamic changed. Like, playing with two players versus four players is very different.
How so?
Well, I feel like, this is a personal opinion. And I've had discussions about this with other RPG players, and everybody has a very different opinion. I personally feel like the optimal amount of players is three, like we originally had in Shift World. I feel like everybody gets an equal amount of time in the narration when there are three players. I feel like as soon as you get to that fourth player, kind of like when you're playing Settlers of Catan, three is like the optimal amount of players. There's enough resources to share equally amongst everyone, but that fourth player always gets less resources and is kind of screwed and can't win the game. I kind of feel like that's how it works around an RPG table as well. As soon as there's a fourth player, he doesn't get to develop his character as much, doesn't get as much time at the table, and I just feel like it's not balanced as well.
Although most games, or many games, maybe that's the D&D model, they want you to have four players. You know, four players is the four main classes. You know, your tank, your whatever it is, controller, your DPS. A balanced party and a healer, of course. And so the four-person party is supposed to have all the abilities.
Yeah. But also in our situation specifically with Shift World is like there was a dynamic for the three brothers, but with one of those brothers being gone, there was like some empty space to try and fill in that Bebar and I both tried to fill in by evolving our characters a little bit, I think.
And going into this last stretch, when we left the game originally, we were at a time where it seemed open-ended. So I was going to bring in different source books and really tease out the mysteries very slowly because it wasn't so important anymore, especially with the fact it wasn't the three brothers, you know. So it was kind of episodic at that point. But coming back to it, one of the requests from the players was, let's solve these mysteries. Let's get some closure. We're not going back to the game to play it in an open-ended way. We're going back to the game to finish it.
Yeah.
So I had my work cut out for me, especially since I did not keep notes as to what was really going on. So I had to reinvent it. I'm not sure it's exactly what I would have done originally. If anything was really gelling in my mind back then, which is not sure, that was lost. So I had to reinvent an ending for this or a reason for this happening. And the settings that we picked would have to sort of inspire what was going to be happening. So there's only four worlds left. We're going to do two today. We're going to do two in a future episode. And that's going to be it for Shift World. I'm sure some of you are breathing a sigh of relief.
No, not me. It's fun to revisit them, even though it's not that far apart from the first episodes we made. You know, to trace back to what Daniel said, being two with the GM, it's like going to see an acoustic set of your favorite artists instead of the full band show. It's more okay. Intimate. It's more fun. I like it.
So, okay, let's go for it. GURPS, Greece. GURPS Greece was written by John Ziegler with interior art by Gene Martin and Shay Ryan, published by Steve Jackson Games, of course, in 1995. It covers ancient Greece, in particular the Heroic Age, 1600 to 1150 BC, and then the Classical Age, which is 800 to 323 BC. So historical background and mythology allowing the Game Master to design a campaign based strictly on historical accuracy or on myth or using a combination of both to create a sort of fantasy. And I did do that in a way. So to start with, let's just talk about mythic versus fantasy versus historical Greece. When you think about, you know, ancient Greece or mythic Greece as a setting, what are you thinking of? And obviously you can use the couple sessions that we played there as inspiration.
Ironically, it was my Achilles.
Your Achilles heel?
Yeah, because I'm not too savvy into old Greece mythology or even Greek history. So for me, it was kind of newish going into that world since I had plunged never in my mind to just go there and say, okay, let's study Greece now. That was never a big point of interest for me, but it was the usual, you know, the Hercules story and everything.
For me, I have a background like a bachelor's in science. So I took so many intro to science, intro to philosophy, all those kinds of classes. And the Greeks are always mentioned. When I think about ancient Greece, I think about the birthing place of culture, basically. And I'm also a video gamer, so many video games will include ancient Greek civilizations to talk about their gods and their mythos. So for me, it's about culture and it's about mythology.
Yeah, I was a big myth kid. I knew the difference between the Greek gods and the Roman gods. You know, they were kind of the same, but had different names, etc. So I was big into that as a kid. So this seemed a very natural place to set a sort of fantasy. I think that we got a chance to do a little bit of classical, a little bit of mythic, because we just came off of time travel. And so I kept an element of time travel. You were in Greece, but you also had a chance through magical temples to go back to the time where the gods just walked around, moving from the present to a sort of pseudo-historical Greece where you might meet not only mythical creatures, but the gods themselves. So to bring the feel of mythic Greece into the game, there was prophetic dreams. Put your character was having prophetic dreams. You met some lesser gods in the wild. You also, there was an owl, follow the owl, and it was that was Athena. So I don't know if you picked up, you know, if like Bert, you're not necessarily up on what's the symbolism, you know, what are the animals and the symbols of the gods. You might not pick up on that stuff.
Never.
Okay.
I will never. It was, like I said, it's my Achilles heel. I don't know much about mythology, Greek mythology, except for what I've seen on TV or in video games. But still, for me, it's gibberish.
It just felt to you that part of it, any fantasy world.
Yeah, totally.
For me, however, like the most memorable part of GURPS Greece was meeting the gods. It made me kind of giddy, the idea that our characters would meet these very famous figures. It's kind of like how in real life, if you meet a celebrity, you kind of get like starstruck. I felt a little starstruck playing GURPS Greece whenever we would meet the gods. I thought that was a really fun part of the adventures.
Yeah, because you save Hermes at the end as part of the plot. And it was like established that, oh, he had to run to Olympus. He was trapped by, it was before the time where there was like the 12 main gods were established, and they were being established at that time. And Hermes was obviously became part of that core. It wasn't always necessarily so. And his, I'm going to call her a sister because all the gods are a family. But Eris, the goddess of discord, who was allied with our villain, trapped him because she wanted to, well, no, I guess Hermes a no-show. Well, I'm here. You know, vote for me. There was like a plot going on in heaven, in Olympus at this point, that you sort of had to cross paths with it. That's what's fun about it, is that there's like, there's something epic going on, and your characters are only part of that story. There was that, and then for ancient or heroic Greece, the present day Greece, or even in the past, that has to hold. You're looking for a particular island. It's got to be in that area of the world as well. That was the feel of it. I gave you clues to which island it might be, and I gave you maps. And in actuality, if you'd looked at actual maps, I don't think that island had the same name on actual maps. So that was the meta clue, if you will. But like, I sent you all of this stuff beforehand. So you remember any of the research you might have done to figure it out?
I Googled so much.
I remember that part of the session very well. It took us a long time to figure out the puzzle. And I was thinking, like, we're never going to get this. We're going to need like a GM intervention or something. Yeah. I think the way we ended up finding it was I was looking for Greek translation of names. And that's how I think we ended up finding a word that meant dark. And I was like, well, the bad guy's called Dark. He's a megalomaniac. He probably created an isle by his name. So I was like, let's go there. And it turned out being the right, yeah.
And to be clear, I think I gave you all of this stuff in between sessions. So it's not like we're not spending time on this together. You're doing research and you know, throwing out names, possibilities in a chat, you know.
Speaking of throwing out names, how come we never get to the fact that the Greek name of Daniel's character was Assos?
I'm sure you made mention of it.
Oh, I made mention of it every time we could. But that was the greatest name you could get, Assos.
Yeah, that was like the Greek translation that we decided that would be the Greek version of Ace.
Right. So let's talk about the characters and how they change, because here's the thing that we did this is part of the bigger plot. And in fact, it took forever before Bert got to play a Greek character. Because in the previous session, and this is just ramping up, the villain that you thought dead, Jeremiah Dark, Darkos in Greek speak, when it was time travel, it was all technology, stole Bert's ability to, well, not Bert, but Willie J, your character, his ability to shift. So when there was a shift, he remained a time traveler, while Ace, Put's character, did change. Now he's got a spear and he's a Greek.
In Austin Powers term, he stole my mojo.
Yes, and this whole adventure in Mythic Greece was how do you get your mojo back? And
that's
when you
right.
get it back, it's going to be magical. But that was one of the clues. The only thing Willie J remembered while he was in a tank being experimented on is that something like Dark was going back to something that, a vortex, a cycle, something like that. And so that was supposed to send you now in this world to the Cyclades archipelago. And in that archipelago, you pinpointed the island that was named after him. But it meant that Bert, you know, had trouble with the various skills that you would need in ancient Greece, you know, because he had not physically or mentally transformed.
That was tough. Well, that was a good challenge to play. Everybody else were acquainted to the atmosphere, to the environment. And for me, I had to play like I knew nothing. And I actually knew nothing. So that was...
It worked out.
That was a fit.
How did you handle your actual Greek character put?
The same way I handle Ace in every shift, I would say.
Okay.
I mean, I made sure that Ace was an archetype more than anything really specific. So it wasn't really that difficult. I just had to make him cocky, and that's it. That's his main trick.
All right. So what do we remember of the story and setting? We know that Paradise, which is your hometown, has now become the actual very real town of Olympia. So you knew you had to return there someday, but you were on a trip, right? The time travel, you were already on a trip, and now you're having to find this island, get Willie J's mojo back, turn him into a Greek. And so it's all happening on this island where there are temples that time travel you to, you know, back into more ancient Greece. It's sort of a Back to the Future thing because the things you change in the past when you came back were actually changed. You know, like a temple is restored. The village isn't under the thumb of Jeremiah Dark and so on.
And I think that might have been like one of the first times where we were trying to, usually we would fight directly against Dark, but this time we were fighting against Dark's influence, the power that he had over a whole community, a whole village, a whole people. So we were not just fighting Dark, but we were fighting the idea of Dark as much as possible. And I feel like, well, maybe a little bit in time travel, we were trying to fight the philosophy of the alternate timeline, which was heavily influenced by Dark. But in Greece, it was like very clear, no, Dark is the leader of this evil philosophy, and he has taken control of this whole island and these people, and we need to help them get away from his grasp.
The whole journey, because it was a journey in Greece, and I think it fits, it was about finding our way into how to get Dark out of that place, how to get Dark out of the influence that he has, the grasp that he has on the village, but also on the whole environment, because when we approached his headquarters, you felt the evil, and we had to do something about it.
It was one of the first shifts where there was a lot of like spiritualism in it, because the gods were there. We were interacting with the gods. Dark was trying to basically become a very powerful god himself. So there was a lot of visiting temples and talking about different religions and different beliefs from the villagers, and that was pretty new to what we usually did as well.
Obviously, you were trying to fix Willie J, but you were also making some good decisions, I think, part and parcel, because when there's only two characters, and in GURPS, where, as we've established before, combat's pretty lethal, you were not prone to getting into physical scrapes necessarily, you know, as much as possible. Let's try to be friends with people. Let's try to trick people, whatever it is. You were friendly with this god of wine, where it was the god of satyrs. So then the satyrs don't attack you. You make friends with the beekeepers. They give you the tools you need to go across the Stygian swamp, which is pestilent. You save a water goddess from a pool and bring her back to the ocean. When she gets there, she causes a tsunami that destroys the evil temple. Even the Cyclops, who were kind of protecting the base where the MacGuffin was, even those guys put you on their shoulders and across the rest of the way back to the village at the end. So every move that you made was in the name of peace, because if in the name of war, you guys would have gotten hurt and killed.
Yeah, definitely. But there's also something meta about it. The fact that we reunited and we wanted to do that character development, and we wanted to play the characters more than just hack and slash it. Quite good with the Greek environment, because like I mentioned earlier on, it was a journey. So the journey took us to think, took us to make good decisions. That was actually great role playing at that time. Good to be with each other talking and having those discussion conversation about the game, within the game.
And at the end, when you come back to the future, you know, I did so much research, guys. It's like everything I wanted to include. I was, you know, reading up some Wikipedia entries. I mean, it's not major research. I wasn't in a library or anything. But, you know, who is this god and what character could I put in here? Or what was happening supposedly in the myths at the time that I'm using it? So one of the things that we did, because there was these beekeepers, actually wasp keepers, that was one of my inspirations, was the play, the Aristophanes play, The Wasps. I had that as a sort of musical Easter egg because our adventure music was actually The Wasps Overture by Ralph Vaughan Williams. Nobody's going to get that, but you know, except me. And then at the end, you get invited to a banquet. There's a play on that's just repeating your adventure, except with leather phalluses and farting bird monsters to amuse the public. But it's your adventure that you're seeing on the stage, because that happened during the mythical times, and it has come up as a story for that the people of this island. Stuff I like to do, right?
Yeah, that was a nice twist, just to come back and, you know, see that we could influence the future of ancient Greece, which could have been catastrophic if we overthought about it.
Well, I kind of like the idea as well that we didn't spend enough time in time travel, to my taste, because that's when the game collapsed. So I got to do a little bit more time travel.
But magical time travel this time. So it was a different flavor of time travel, which was fun.
Yeah, it had some, it felt like an epic. Okay, well, now we're moving mountains. Our two characters are making big moves. We had an effect on Greek mythology.
For more discussions on different types of time travel, see previous episode.
And the soundtrack. So I mentioned I used the Wasps Overture. And then the theme was just, I used the Mandalorian theme. It's got something, I don't know, Spartan about it, Trojan about it. There's something like ancient sounds, ancient instruments about it. But I didn't go full soundtrack. And so you won't find a YouTube playlist like I usually do just for Greece. I think it was like two sessions.
Yeah, it was not that long. But I have a confession to make. I haven't watched The Mandalorian until I heard the theme song.
Okay. And that made you want to watch it?
I watched it. I'm up to date now.
Okay.
But yeah, that was the theme song was so good. I said to myself, okay, if the theme song is that good, that TV show must be good.
And since we didn't spend a lot of time in Greece, we're not going to spend a lot of time on Greece. We really want to get to space. So we'll take a small break. When we return, a longer discussion about GURPS space and also a little bit about West End Games Star Wars RPG.
Star Wars, nothing but Star Wars. Give me the Star Wars. Don't let them in.
Give me those Star Wars, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
We're back, and in the second half, we're discussing GURPS space.
Ooh, my favorite.
Yeah, definitely my favorite.
Oh, yeah. GURPS space was, to me, was like the Old West. Well, I mean, there are similarities if you're going the Star Wars way. What I mean is Old West, you know, when we shifted, it was like, well, that's kind of too bad. We're playing Shift World because that was going great.
Old West was a lot of fun. Yeah.
And
I agree.
And then space, same thing. Space, I actually had extra adventures kind of ready to go, but it's like, no, we really want to get to the end. We don't want to play chapters that don't progress the main story. So I ended up scrapping them, you know, because we wanted to get to the end sooner. But it was a lot of fun. GURPS Space is a toolkit that enables game masters to create science fiction role-playing campaigns using the GURPS rules. There are guidelines provided for designing games using science fantasy, space opera, or hard science fiction genres by creating worlds, planets, and alien races. It was one of the first genre books to come out from GURPS with material from a host of different writers, but principally designed by Steve Jackson and William Barton. First edition of the book came out in 1986, but when the definitive third edition of GURPS came out, which is the one we used, a second edition of Space soon did too, in 1988. That one was well supported with specific settings, space atlases, GURPS aliens, a space bestiary, technology books, and some adventures as well. It also won the 1989 Origins Award for Best Role-Playing Supplement of 1988. Third edition Space in 1990. The same book, basically, but they tweak some information. The design looks better, etc. They also changed the vehicle rules because they had new vehicle rules by that point. GURPS 4th also came out with a space book. All right, before we get into the nitty-gritty of our own adventures there, gaming in space. What are your favorite tropes about the space opera genre?
Everything.
It's all fun. But I think for me, my favorite, I was thinking about this in preparation for this podcast. I think for me, it's the space station. The idea of having one place where there are so many NPCs that you can get to know and interact with. And they're all so very different because they come from so many different cultures, races, planets, etc.
I was the perspective of space flight that was, very attractive at first. But yeah, the space station, the possibilities, I got sucked in quick.
Obviously, I'm a big Deep Space Nine fan. Many of us enjoyed Babylon 5 as well. You know, it's the same idea, famously. But I think that's why I related to the Old West so well, because the Old West was just that one town. And we did some traveling about, but it was about, especially in the beginning, exploring this supporting cast. Right. When we do some episodic stuff where they go elsewhere, there's a lot of travel. And this is going to happen in this part of the campaign as well. We lose touch with those characters. But when we're there, it just feels so much more alive. I love the one setting. And it's kind of too bad that you can't always do that. That a lot of the time you're traveling in RPGs just to get to the adventure. But a place where the adventures come to you, particularly special.
Yeah, I agree. I was thinking about that during the prep for this episode, like, I think I figured out that for me, the magic element, the one thing that makes an RPG amazing is the supporting cast. Like, that is the most important thing for me. Character interaction is so important. It helps character development so much.
Playing with those characters, reviving the whole village, but into a space station, it was very nice. It was pretty cool. It brought back to our roots.
One of the problems with the space opera in GURPS anyways, or any game, you know what, any game, is ship combat. That's a good reason to stay on a station, frankly, because what happens during ship combat? If your ship is damaged and this is destroyed, that kills everybody. So hold on. And is there something for everyone to do? And if you're fewer players, is there too much to do for, you know? So this is always kind of a problem. And GURPS space offers a number of solutions. So like the original GURPS space second edition, the one I have with the big Jupiter on it, that had a system. The new version of GURPS with the new vehicle rules obviously had its own. And then the GURPS Traveler, which is also obviously a space opera based on the Traveler game, also had a different version. So I ended up kind of kid bashing a number of them. I don't even know which one I picked, but I ended up choosing a way for it to work. I don't know if it was ever satisfying.
The main goal is the story. So for combat, we didn't touch it until the third session?
Late, yeah.
So for us, we were so into the story that, you know, combat was just, okay, let's not die. It was just...
I've been walking away more and more from combat in RPGs. I like it less and less. And vehicle combat has always been the worst type of combat. I think the only time where I really liked it was when we did GURPS Mecha, because we got to design our own vehicle in character generation. So that was a lot of fun. I felt a lot more into my vehicle and I wanted to test it out in combat. If you don't get the players engaged into really liking their vehicle because they're already involved in the creation of it. To be honest, I don't even remember how we did it in GURPS space.
I'll tell you, it was like a contest of tactics. who's the better tactician, and that gave you bonuses. And then gunners declared their level of aggression, so you would sacrifice dodge to get more damage. Then there were attacks, rolled an attack. The damage was based on the level of aggression, and then you rolled on a table that decided what systems were kaput, you know, like how much of your shields were down, and it's the cargo this time, or it's the weapons, or it's... It had some variety, but it's also pretty dangerous. It feels like, well, what if the game master rolls too well and you end up destroying the ship that you need to get to the other adventures or the other parts of the adventure? And I never liked it in any space opera that I ever played. There's something about it that's not quite... And it's true of all vehicle combat, I agree. It's like if you destroy the vehicle, that's worse than, you know, hurting a particular player.
Yeah, and the only environment where it's very well played is in video games anyway. For those who are playing video games, I'm playing Starfield right now, which is the big thing. In Starfield, you have both. You do quests, you are on the land, you're on a space station, and you also pilot your own ship. But the mechanics are made for that. When you roll, it's a whole other story. The way GURPS functions, it's way more dangerous than it seems to be. And so you have to be very careful of what you think and what you do. And you have to see who you're facing too, because you could get steamrolled pretty quickly.
Your characters were always cautious ever since somebody took a bullet in Old West and realized that's the damage and that's my hit points. Oh, no.
That's GURPS.
Yeah, that's GURPS. Although we did use cinematic points, like in this one, we had cinematic points that allowed you to be more like action heroes. Because here's the thing. GURPS space is a little dry. It's a little hard SF in general because of GURPS's bent towards realism and lethal combat, etc. It just feels more like hard. We used... I used Star Wars Adventures as the sort of skeletons on which to put the flesh of our adventures. So I wanted more space swashbucklers, right? Star Wars without the Jedi, essentially. Although if 12, that character, had been around, he had psionic powers already in the other worlds. So he would have kind of been a Jedi in a way. And then what I did was replace all the aliens that were in those adventures with GURPS aliens. I always felt that GURPS aliens was a great resource, had a lot of interesting types, you know, sort of aliens you could kind of recognize, the honorable, the treacherous, the pack rat, the, you know, you understood the types that you would see in Star Wars or Star Trek, but they gave them some interesting spins and tweaks to make them alien.
Was it a card game that you made us play was inspired by Star Wars or something?
We'll get to that when we talk about the campaign. But yes, no, we played Sarlacc, which is point blank. That's the game that Lando and Han play. So it was exactly that game. So yeah, it was still Star Wars, but, you know, filed off the numbers in most cases. And then, of course, using, and I'll ask you what you thought of this, but using Star Wars Adventures, West End put a lot of humor in their adventures. I used Crisis on Cloud City and Scavenger Hunt, for those who know. And that seems normal for a company that also gave us Paranoia, who also put a lot of weird humor in Torg. Many of their games had a humorous side to them. And that played to our strengths because we're improv players. And it took us a bit away from Star Wars itself, which I'm not saying is a serious franchise, but it's not necessarily known for its comedy. It felt less like Star Wars, maybe. So my question is, we're talking about mythic, we're talking about epic, we're talking about big action, swashbuckling, etc., which is what I was pushing for. Does the comedy take away from that?
I think it bolsters it. When your characters don't take themselves too seriously, it gives the impression that they're so confident that things will go well that it makes them feel that much more powerful. It's like, well, this guy isn't even worried about the imminent death that's around him. He must be so good at what he does. So I feel like the humor actually makes things, well, it makes it more fun. But I think it adds to the epicness of the thing, yeah.
And also the dynamic we add, the NPCs' involvements. The NPCs are very important in Paradise because they make this whole universe real and standalone of, you know, what would be Star Wars or Star Trek or any star adventure that you could see.
It would feel very dry, I think, without the humor. Like, Star Wars has Han Solo. You know what I mean? Like a huge Wookiee for a sidekick. There's humor in that genre. It belongs there, I think.
And I think your characters were easily adapted because by this point, we've done the action heroes. We've done the vehicle-based characters. Ace has been a car driver, so he can be a hotshot pilot. But he could also be a gambler, and that's why I brought the Sarlacc game in. You know, I wanted that poker game element.
And I was the Wookiee.
And, well, yeah, you're the Wookiee in one sense. You're R2-D2 in another. So on the ship, you're the guy that repairs it. You're the engineer. So it takes two guys to fly the Clover, the Trèfle, as we call it. That was Ace's horse originally. Now it's a spaceship. You know, your characters were easily fit into that environment. Simone, who was Ace's love interest, is still a singer. There's a bar, Club Paradise. It was a saloon. Now it's a bar inside a space station. The trolls from the Vikings come back. But of course, now they're GURPS aliens. They're the Cronin, who are sort of the Klingons of the GURPS universe. We could bring back characters like that who used to be fantasy races, but now they're aliens. And if we're talking about character development, this is where I started pushing the relationship with Simone. How was that? And did you believe I was going to kill her off?
I don't think she was... Well, actually...
She almost dies in this part.
Yes, during the AI invasion. Yeah, I think maybe I thought for that section that she might leave. I was preparing my character for whatever. But yeah, definitely this shift was the one that did the most character development. Willie J had such a character arc in this shift. He went from being the stupid brother that just is always agreeable with everything, always following Ace, and this shift he just like got pissed off, would not take it anymore, and kept having arguments and fights with his brother. And that was my favorite part of the whole shift, I think.
What were you thinking, Bert?
That was actually a revelation for Willie J, because he left for a reason in the story. He left because he wanted to be more up to speed with his inner engineering and everything. So Willie J bringing it back to space, it fits perfectly as an engineer to have him be there, but also to have his expertise played out. And that's why he got pissed off, because it didn't work with his brother. He saw that he was sucking in the whole shifting story into Simone's life, and he became very serious, telling him, you know what, either you go all the way, or either you let her go and let her be, because this might kill us.
This was your reinterpretation of the character. You know, we're coming back to it 15, 20 years later. We've talked about this before. You know, it's like, what is this character now?
Yeah, where is he at?
Yeah, where is he at? And what did I used to do? And now I'm older. What am I doing now?
I think also the way it kind of ended up playing out, or at least the impression that I got of it, was that Willie J was seeing Ace getting really serious about marrying Simone and making a life and a family with Simone. And Willie J was feeling left out, like he was going to be alone after that happens. And that was kind of like, that's the way I interpreted it. That's why he was acting up from my point of view. But yeah. I thought it was genius. I thought it was so fun.
Even though he was a loner, he didn't want to be alone anymore, which is paradoxical in a point, but still.
Well, I think they were getting older, you know, yeah. Like they were growing up, because there's an arc. So you're seeing how originally that was the character template. As we move towards an ending, the characters are, okay, now, okay, you know, this is actually important to me. And the same thing with Ace. Now, yeah, he used to be a womanizer. The thing with Simone, and now it's getting serious, and I'm sort of pushing it. I'm having, like, the dad invite you to dinner and that sort of stuff. It's like, where is this going? I had the feeling, because I'm very good at creating a sense of paranoia.
Agreed.
I think you're just a paranoid player. So you started thinking that either I would kill her off here because she gets the AI virus, or that maybe what I was pushing for was to split them up, that she was going to be unhappy with this whole situation, the shifting and the adventures, and it's like enough is enough. I was kind of trying to kind of play that up. Well, at the same time, I was ready to bank left. Maybe that's for the next episode, because we're going to get to an ending in that case. The big piece that I wanted to do in this early portion of GURPS Space was for the 12 character that Sly was playing and didn't end up coming. But I didn't want to sacrifice my reveal that his father was... I mean, this is Star Wars, right? His father was the supervillain.
Oh my God, I never even made the connection with Darth Vader.
He's, you know, Jeremiah Dark was his... He was an orphan. Yeah. He was shifting. You guys were shifting because your parents were shifting. Wait a minute. Who are 12's parents?
We were so into the story that you're telling us this now and we realize it. I feel kind of stupid not realizing it while we were doing it. But still, it's a great play.
Everybody was a child of a shifter.
Yeah.
Okay. And the other big transformation, I guess, is Quark's on the station was Oily Pete's. Who Oily Pete used to be Ace's arch enemy, but he's just a B-level boss. But he used to be his arch enemy. When he died, Greasy Gill, his brother, came up. And the names kind of inspired me to make them droids. And then if Greasy Gill was going to be destroyed in this, and almost was he? Maybe he was.
Yeah, he was. He was. Yeah. You replaced him by somebody else with another funky
Dirty
name.
Dick, who was...
Yeah, that was exactly that.
The guy who built them. So their dad now runs the bar. But that's where we had the Sarlacc. I said Sarlacc like it's the Sarlacc pit, right? That's not the name of the game. It's, what is it, Sabacc? So apologies, you Star Wars nerds. I know I said Sarlacc like everybody's going, that's the pit? Sabacc is the game. And that's the game that we ended up playing. And we had to play this. Everybody had a pack of cards, specially shuffled, you know, on each of our ends because we had to play this not at the same table. You know, there's a version online. You can find the rules. I had to watch a few tutorials to figure it out. But I really wanted Ace to be a gambler again. That was like his original concept.
Yeah, and I enjoyed me, Daniel, the player. I enjoyed combing through the rules and figuring out how to optimally play this game. I spent some time figuring out the probabilities on how to play Sabacc.
That's you, probability guy.
Yeah. That's typically you, actually. Over-researching everything just to make sure that you do it the right way, the way you want to do it.
There may or may not have been Excel sheets.
There was.
So we're into the adventures now. We're talking about what actually happened. Originally, I will say I had planned to use GURPS Teradyne rather than space. Teradyne is a space. Obviously, it's a space thing, but it's a separate setting. On the cover, there's a space station. So that's what I was drawn to. And it just takes place in the solar system. It's not the wide galaxy. A little more grounded. And then I ended up going the Star Wars route instead, which I think we had more fun with. Two main adventures and all the subplots going. The first one, robots go berserk. They're infected by a new AI. That AI is trying to take over, not only take over the station, but like spread gas that will turn people into metal, turn people into robots. And that's what's happening to Simone, etc.
I am your automatic lover. Automatic lover.
12's mother, also on the line, she's been knocked out by this. And so she can't give this information. And the information that she has, she also knows where your parents' lab is. And that's going to bring us like, okay, now we're going to get through that mystery. So before that happens, well, you got to defeat the AI and so on and have all these fights and action going.
It was a nice twist for me because I wasn't expecting, you know, the whole space station detective work at first. Because when we came in, we were in the spaceship. So in my head, we were not going to play this space station and work it out for a session or two. The cinematic points were... actually pretty useful, entertaining. The whole story, you know, trying to break out those nano invasions, it was very interesting. Very, very interesting.
I remember I really liked the adventure seed of being accused of murder and then being hired by the police to do the detective work ourselves or on our own crime to prove ourselves innocent. I really like that as an adventure seed. It would work in any genre, and I thought that was a lot of fun. It was also fun to like burn the police chief by telling him he was incompetent, so he needed to hire criminals to do his job for him.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun too.
He's always been a foil for you guys. One of the things that worked well in terms of humor was the character called Helm, who was a lame alien. Like he had like a golden skin that used to flake, so it could have been paint. And he's supposed to be a con man. He's like a low-level criminal, and you guys humiliated him at the Sabacc table, and then later later he gets really punished for his betrayals. He's last seen drifting in a broken spaceship, going down into the nearby planet's atmosphere sort of thing.
That was fun and epic to do.
Yeah, one of the things that was epic about it is that big fight in the hangar. We also had the Cronin ambassador there, who was also part of the game, or the Sabacc game. Like, I was playing him with, this guy's got unlimited cinematic points. He's doing some crazy parkour on top of spaceships, etc. So I wanted to show, okay, this is what you can do with cinematic points if you use them well. You need some teachable moments sometimes when you're going to use a different mechanic.
Yeah, and the Cronin was actually targeted by us as the enemy at first in the story. And finally, we had to work with him to make the story unfold.
And then at the end, there's a big fight with an AI tentacle monster before the gas bombs explode all over the station. So it was epic in the sense that the action is epic, right? The stakes are local, but you can still make it big just because the characters can kind of do anything, as in an action movie. That brings us to our second adventure, really, in this, because then you find out where your parents' base is supposed to be. She gives you a lot of information about Jeremiah Dark and his relationship to the parents and how she became pregnant by him. And then everybody had to run away from the station because Dark was up to no good. He was going to use this graviton thing to break reality. Sound familiar? Yeah, reality's kind of broken. And he wanted to control realities, whereas your parents wanted to fix the problem. So by the end, they all leave hyperspace, the station, to unknown coordinates. There you go. You're off into space. And I wanted you to have, it's a space opera. Let's not just do the space station. Let's do an outer space adventure. And that one, based on Scavenger Hunt, it has crazy aliens, first of all. There's a lot of weirdo aliens, these sort of giant rats or chipmunks or whatever it is. And then like these other ones are shapeshifters types, but everybody's kind of goofy looking, which is Star Wars, everybody's a Muppet.
And we have a cooking droid.
Yeah. And they gave you a cooking droid, which was, I think, the big comedy piece in this section.
Yeah. I remember we were trying to use them as much as we could do to make it. It was mostly a decoy. At the end,
but at the beginning, I mean, you use them to convince an alien race to trust you. Like, he cooked their recipe, and so there was stuff in there that made him useful, but he was also kind of a funny character that always spoke in cooking terms.
Yeah.
He was a C-3PO.
Kind of. And the idea was that you get to the coordinates, station's not there, but these aliens know how to detect it. You need a graviton to detect the station, because on the station there's a graviton. I guess that's, and maybe the graviton is also can be used to push the station into our reality. All right, where do we get a graviton? Well, you can get a graviton. What we really want is you to give a black eye to this church. I guess these aliens have this holy site, which is really a dump, kind of spaceship graveyard within a big field of debris, which they call holy. So you have to navigate their culture, get to the planet, get inside that ship that has a portable graviton in it, escape with it. All these space donuts, their ships look kind of like donuts, coming after you. At the same time, I'm bringing back Lupita, who was a character in the early games. She used to be like a Mexican bandita. Now she's a space pirate. You need space pirates. It's a space opera.
Always.
And she's also after this graviton, and, she causes problems. It's a very lively part of the adventure.
Yeah, I really like the imagery of basically a whole solar system of trash floating around this graviton feel. I thought that was a very interesting, unique visual. And I remember, like you said, we were trying to navigate their culture. I remember that being a lot of fun too, trying to figure out, well, okay, these guys are very different. They have very specific ceremonies for their social gatherings and stuff. And I thought that was a lot of fun to try and figure out and role play.
Yeah, I definitely, I changed a lot of things, obviously, to make it fit. But I definitely would recommend the two adventures that we use. And I kind of, man, I wish I was playing Star Wars RPG now. after reading a couple of these, I was like, yeah, this is pretty cool. There's a lot of humor, which I like. So, and strange aliens that you don't see in the movies are just created for the products. And then I'm also using their personalities from GURPS Aliens and putting on there. So I'm not sure which is which now, you know?
And also the fight around the crash ship, I remember, was a lot of fun. We use a lot of cinematic moments in that one. Wasn't there like a buggy, like hitting a ramp and stuff like that?
Yeah, because we have to enter it, and we had a couple ways in, but the best way was the sneaky way, which was not really sneaky, but
a loud buggy.
Yeah, with the loud buggy. But yeah, when you called it epic, you know, that session was made by the cinematic points.
Yeah, it had to be a little bit Fast and the Furious in parts. Once you're out in space and trying to escape, you actually did use the three-dimensional space, get the ships to fire on one another by positioning yourself and stuff like this. So whether or not I kind of initiated those possibilities or you were thinking in three dimensions doesn't really matter. I felt like, okay, now we're really doing space opera dogfighting pretty well at that point. So I was happy with it. Eventually, you get to the space station. These are revelations. Since we're talking about Shift World, let's talk about them. You get inside the station. You see vestiges of your childhood. Maybe you remember things. Maybe you don't. I think maybe Ace might have been still in his mom's belly since he was the youngest.
It was mostly about Johnny because Johnny was born.
You were a baby or something. In any case, yeah. You know, you see the giant graviton. You find out, you look at the diaries. You find out that the original timeline, the original setting, was essentially GURPS Atomic Horror. Roswell, flying saucer, they found the graviton in there. It was created by these aliens, and then they experimented on it, and then reality started to change. Jeremiah Dark and the parents, they knew what was going on, so that is reflected in their diary. So you learn more about the original experiments and what they were trying to do, and the parents are saying, if you find this, destroy the graviton, destroy the core of this machine so that it, you know, can't be used by Dark ever again. And so you do, but while it's building up its power to self-destruct, Lupita shows up. She says, you know, I just wanted to give you a heads up, boys. We just stole the mini graviton from your ship and scuttled it. The ship, that is. You're kind of stuck here, etc. We're blowing this up. So everybody runs to the airlock, and Lupita finds out that her crew betrayed her. And they're leaving with the graviton, and she's stuck on this station, and your own ship, the only escape, is scuttled. It doesn't work, and it's floating away, dead. So as this happens, the core explodes, and you find yourself on a desert island. An 18th century ship sinks. The pirates are leaving with the graviton, which is now some sort of tiki idol, and we've shifted again. We've shifted to Pirates of the Caribbean, basically.
Yeah, that was a great segue. That was a universe that we hope that we would visit.
Right, because I asked at the very beginning, I'd asked, okay, what are some settings that you would like to see? And I couldn't promise everything. I know that Japan came up and we never used it. But Swashbucklers was one of them, right?
I remember I felt very, very enthusiastic about it because I wanted it to happen. And the way you brought it was pretty nice, actually. Let's say the perfect segue to a great adventure in space.
Yeah, and it was a sort of interesting cliffhanger too, because basically the station we were on was going to blow up and we had no way out. And we're trying to figure out how are we going to get out of here and like trying to find a plan on getting out. And then it just explodes and we're like, shit, are we dead? No, you dum-dums, you're shifters. Here's a new shift. You survived because the explosion was behind you and you're on an island and you're okay. So, oh, thank God. I was like, I forgot about that.
Well, I always like to do the thing where, you know, it's like you get to the airlock and you see the ship flying away and the breeze hits you with the foam of the ocean. And it's like just change it within the sentence of the description, give you something that doesn't make any sense with the space thing, but it's suddenly that.
Yeah, just to confuse the brain for a minute, yeah.
So what did you think of the revelations at this point?
Pretty interesting. The chunkiest information that we ever had playing Shift World. So there was a lot to figure out. Dark was working with our parents, and they were not agree on how things should go, and that our parents left us that message that we should go after him and destroy his plans. Okay, we had the sense that, okay, this is coming to an end. This is coming to a closure. We are there.
Yeah, it gave us purpose.
Yeah.
It answered our questions on why we were shifters, who we were, and it gave us a very clear goal. I mean, the goal was always, obviously, to eliminate Dark. But now we had a not just a personal reason to do it, but also a reason that kind of fit on the scale of the whole multiverse, I guess, universe. Yeah. Like we had to save not just ourselves and figure out, answer our questions. Our questions were now answered, and now we had to save everybody else. So it was very satisfying.
Because Dark, much of this is going to be revealed in the next episode, really, as Lupita spills the beans. But, you know, Dark wants the Graviton. You know, Lupita was working for Dark at that moment. Her men left her there. They're going to bring the Graviton to Dark, and he's going to try to control the multiverse with it, you know, whatever it is, whatever that means. So it is, again, where the stakes have to, this time the stakes are not local. The stakes are personal, getting to the station, and then they turn like, okay, this could be devastating. This could be not a game changer, a game ender. So we keep the epicness, whether that's revealing something important about the characters and their past and the mystery that I see, that's epic. That is mythic when we are going back to the parents, etc. You know, in a personal life, the mythic is your family tree, is the stuff that made you you, that led to your existence. That's the mythic of the personal. So if we're talking about mythic stuff, which I decided was kind of the artificial theme of the episode, that's what you're trying to do, even though you're not necessarily playing in a mythological game. Although space has its own mythology, and I think Star Wars is very mythological, which is why I kind of adopted it from, you know, go from Greece to this, I had to keep something. And in the same way, from space to swashbucklers, well, I did say it was kind of space swashbucklers in the first place. Let's talk a bit about the soundtrack. This is a soundtrack that I will put in the show notes. You can look at what the tracks are, get a link to a YouTube playlist that we used for this game. Usually, you think space opera, you probably think orchestral music. It's orchestral music in Star Trek. It's orchestral music in Star Wars. It's orchestral with ancient instruments in Battlestar Galactica, and even a new one. So that was kind of different, but still orchestral. So I went with Buck Rogers in the 25th century and space disco, just to have a different sound to it.
Yeah, that was a nice twist, actually.
That wasn't like, oh, this is dumb.
For me, it kind of was, to be honest, a little bit.
Oh, no, I enjoyed it. I mean,
it's just not the atmosphere that I was imagining. That's all it is. I enjoy space disco. But I was not, like, when I was picturing our stories, I was picturing something more orchestral.
Because I actually used the Buck Rogers theme as the theme for the show, for this part. Because, I mean, the theme with the words. When you listen to the words, it's about, is this life real or is this just a dream? And it seemed to talk about waking up from a shift. You know, it's about Buck Rogers finding himself in the 25th century. But it could also work with that element. What am I? Who am I? What will I be? Where am I going? And what will I see? Searching my mind for some truth to reveal. What thoughts are fantasy? What memories real? And then I use a lot of space disco songs, you know, about robots and about flying spaceships and all this sort of stuff. I think the soundtrack is actually listenable. I've listened to it several times.
It is. It is. And it actually put us in that mood, you know, because we wanted to be funny and accessible in a way in the comedy of all things. I think it was a great choice. It's still maybe not Daniel's first choice, but for me, it was not a curveball. It was just, that's what we were doing. Okay, that's good. And the soundtrack was just blending.
At this point, I would normally mention product recommendations. So I will point people towards GURPS Aliens. I think it's one of the few books I have read in its entirety. At one point, I even considered doing a pseudo Star Trek campaign where I would have replaced all the known races with weirdo analogs from the book. So yeah, the Cronin would have been the Klingons, the Ka would have been the Romulans and so forth. I ended up not doing it, but I think GURPS Aliens is always a good inspiration for me when I look through it. And I tried to include, I think there's maybe a dozen of the aliens from the books that I put in the campaign. They weren't always important, but, you know, as colors sometimes. So there's that. I think the space atlases are a little bit dry. It's like 2 pages or 4 pages per planet. There's a map. It's a, that's where it feels very hard SF for me. But they've also got like bigger ones. GURPS Unite is just one planet that they develop a lot. Yes, great place to set a campaign on a single planet. To me, that's not space opera. It can be GURPS Space, it can be GURPS Sci-Fi, but it's not space opera very much because it's just one planet. So if you are going to want to play like just one world, I think GURPS Unite is actually a pretty good book. So those would be some of my product recommendations. Let's talk lessons. What did we learn about gaming from these environments?
Cinematic points are useful to create moments for what you want it to be. So yeah, I think it's a great add-up to these sessions.
For me, it's don't go light on the cast. The supporting cast is very important. They create a lot of opportunities for the narrative, for the PCs and their relationship amongst each other. Like a lot of what was happening between our PCs in GURPS Space was happening because of what was happening between my character and his NPC girlfriend. So I think a lot of really well thought out supporting cast can really help a campaign.
I think that's where you also went more emotional, like whether you're emotional about her or Bert was very emotional about his mother. He's always been a bit of a mama's boy, but then, you know, connecting to his childhood and seeing his mother on a screen, etc., that had an emotional impact that you let your character have. Again, the mythic of the personal. And if I bring it back to mythic, don't be afraid to make it big. Big action, big stakes, big NPCs, you know, memorable because they're so broad maybe, big concepts. And also don't be afraid to make it funny to counterbalance it. There's epic and then there's maybe it's too serious. So in our case, I got it from the players here. Silly aliens and robots didn't take away from the big moments or the emotion of Simone almost dying or, you know, any of that, the various shocks and revelations. I suppose it's kind of the MCU style play. There's comedy, there's action, it's epic, but it's silly. It was a full meal. And so that was GURPS Space. I want to thank my guests, Put Wellette, the Ace of Spade, and Willie J's own Bert Hébert. Thank you, guys.
You're welcome. It was fun to be here.
I'll let you go back to the ship, and I'll be back after the break with Game Master advice and your feedback on our previous episode.
Space. The final frontier. These are the recordings of the podcast Gimme That Star Trek. Its ongoing mission, to explore all of Star Trek, to seek out new guests and new opinions, to boldly go where many have gone before.
Gimme That Star Trek. A new episode every month, only at fireandwaterpodcast.com and on iTunes.
If I were Dungeon Master, I'd have it made.
What an interesting proposition. Very well, I shall give you all my power to use as you will.
Starting a space opera role-playing game is a little daunting. Saying there's a whole universe to explore is overstating it because you don't have infinite time to play in an infinite setting, but even focusing on only part of a galaxy or a quadrant or even a single system can seem pretty infinite compared to other types of games where you might explore a continent or a single city. It's definitely scalable, but it all depends on your choices. So let's talk about those. Where can you go? There are really two limiting factors in space opera. The first is the character's autonomy. Can they do anything they like and chart their own course, or is that course predicated on missions handed from on high? The latter is much easier. If the characters are part of, okay, let's call it Starfleet or Earth Force or some intelligence service, a higher ranking officer will give them the scenario hook and off they go. The GM will have prepared the world, the aliens, the tech, and the plot for that specific mission. Now, the characters are self-employed, like the veteran adventurers you make in Traveler, for example. they could decide to point their ship in any direction. The GM can certainly adapt some stories to another environment or even political structure, but may feel safer not giving the PCs their own ship. That way, he can give them shipboard adventures, you know, murder on the Nile in space, while he prepares the next pit stop planetary adventure. In other words, it's easier to run the rebels than Han Solo. Well, I suppose you could give them their own ship, but if travel distances are slow, you could still buy time by throwing space anomalies and space pirates at them en route. See, the second factor is technology. How are ships getting around? Long semi-realistic voyages or blink of an eye hyperspace? Or are there jump points which direct traffic to well-planned locations? It's not just about speed either. Do sensors tell them anything or everything well in advance? Are there complete astrogation charts, or can the GM plop almost any planet anywhere? Does FTL radio keep information flowing? Decisions you make about available technology will expand or shrink your setting. So what's in a setting? Whether you're creating a universe from scratch or choosing a prefab setting, there are several questions you have to answer. For example, what is humanity's place in this universe in comparison and contrast to other species? In Star Trek, there are many alien races, and the most important ones have largely monolithic cultures, sometimes even empires, of a kind, to oppose or ally with humanity. In Star Wars, the aliens are more alien-looking, but the Empire seems to have homogenized the culture by displacing individuals all over. Humanity just seems to be the most common. In the Foundation novels, there are no aliens at all, and you wouldn't expect them in a low-scale, near-future solar system-based opera either. In the Alien/Predator universe, alien life almost always seems to be deadly, and humans are food or trophies. Now, what about robots? Mechanical life is a science fiction trope, but need not be a space opera staple, except it often is. Trek has very few sentient androids. Star Wars has droids, who appear to be a semi-sentient slave race. In Battlestar Galactica, there's been an uprising of the machines, and they want to destroy humanity. This also seems to have happened in Asimov's Foundation continuity, and AI are banned. In any case, are they alien minds, devoid of consciences? Are they ruled by the three laws of robotics? Or are they de facto humans with special abilities? And if you decide to include robots, can they be player characters? And if mechanical beings exist, what about cyborgs? How much cyberpunk do you want in your setting? Now, there are obviously other tech concerns besides bots and ship engines. How magical is the technology in your part of the universe? Transmat beams, replicators, and holodecks? The more you goose up your tech, the more difficult it might be to create a threat for the PCs, as countless TV writers have found. The real question is, do you want an economy in your game? Or is scarcity a thing of the past? If there is no scarcity, PCs can get their hands on any equipment within legal reason, and villains can't have greed as a motivation. Again, there are ways around this, but, you know, generally. And what about weapons? In Star Wars, which is a combat-heavy setting, blasters act like guns and lightsabers like katana. Fighter craft have dogfights as if they were planes. This is pure space opera, and other franchises have generally gone that route too. But if you're looking for realism, perhaps we never gave up on projectile weapons. And normal swords are great at puncturing spacesuits, as in Traveler. What's medicine like? Entertainment? Computer interfaces? All of this needs some thought. Another world-building cheat used by Star Wars is to give planets a single ecosystem. We know that's not realistic, but it makes each one easy to remember, presents its own specific challenges, and in a world that essentially uses swords, guns, and planes, by any other name, it's the equivalent of the old matinee idol globetrotting to dark jungles, arid deserts, and snowy mountains. In Star Trek, it's much the same, but the focus is more on monocultures. So planets that work like gangster empires, Roman provinces, or some Orwellian ideal. A more realistic approach would make planets more varied geophysically and socially, but then are you really going to visit the whole thing? If your game is set on a single planet for any length of time, that's just a sci-fi game. It may not be space opera. In space opera, that one outpost might as well represent the whole planet, so who cares what the polar region is like? One science fiction element we haven't mentioned is espers. Are psionics available to PCs or others? Star Wars has its Jedi and its Sith. Trek has telepathic aliens like Vulcans and Betazoids. What role do they have in society? Are they clearly marked as such? Enslaved? Banned and hunted down? Just normal? Does it depend on the planet or the region of space? Because the last question is, what's the general political structure of your setting? Are there giant powers jostling for power or peace, all of which interact with one another and which the GM must keep in mind? Is there a monolithic empire that must be fought against or for, with rebels or terrorists striking necessarily from within? Is the universe more mercantile than political, with loose alliances of planets trading with others for what they need? Games like Traveller and GURPS Space are sort of like this. Is every world so isolated no real structure is possible? Say in a low-tech game where relativity makes dates meaningless and or people spend long trips in suspended animation? And ultimately, your choices will depend on what you want to do in your game. Is it military like 2300 AD? A space western Shambara like Star Wars? Exploration missions and moral puzzles like Trek? Are the characters freewheeling rogues or enlisted officers in some kind of space corps? Do they live on a station where the action comes to them or based on a ship, seeking it out, or as in BSG, running from it? Very often the question boils down to what genre is actually under the surface. World War, Cold War, espionage, samurai, western, anime, horror, pulp, cops and robbers, even sword and sorcery can be given a space opera skin. And when I played GURPS Space, I went through that process myself. And I added another question for myself. What soundtrack should this campaign have? Having already surprised myself by making a lot of Star Wars-y choices, I also did not go with the big symphonic score. Having grown up on such classics as Space 1999 and Buck Rogers, I instead opted for Space Disco. I think it works with the roguish, sexy, but also goofy PCs that inhabit the campaign. And sometimes you just make a choice for the sake of surprise. Whether that's music or any of the other questions that we talked about, it's a good tip to keep your players on their toes and also give your campaign, your space opera, its own kind of special, maybe quirky flavor. Feedback on our previous episode, which was about the Marvel Universe RPG from the early 2000s. My guest was Ryan Blake. It's the Marvel game with the stones, right? So Ian Fletcher had quite an involved response. He says, excellent episode. I think you and Ryan did the best job you could trying to find the bright side of a system that neither of you were enthused about. And Ryan's closing comments that there is half a good idea in there is quite accurate. I've seen the DNA of this system appear in subsequent heroic RPGs. The panels, pages kind of framing has appeared in several games following this one. This is a system I have a lot of direct experience with as well. I grabbed all three of these books when they came out, and for a while, this was the game we played around the house. You see, one big draw of this game was that it was diceless. My partner at the time was a notoriously poor roller and seemed cursed by whatever spirits controlled the results of die rolls. So having a game where this randomizer was removed was a bonus in her books. As well, we tended towards a heavy narrative style, which the game meshed well with. This isn't to say that your complaints about the game weren't accurate. We developed a sort of etiquette for the GM to not spend more than a certain amount each round. And with that gentleman's agreement in place, the players were able to manage their resources better. I think we also increased the redstone recovery rate, even moving it away from durability or intelligence, and turning it into more of a flat value. Like Ryan, our game became increasingly house-ruled to make use of the system, but I cannot say we didn't have fun because we played the heck out of this game. And he gives more comments, more specific ones. The lines of experience, for example, that was referring to the method you would use to keep track of your progression. On the back of the CAD, you had an experience section where you could write down these lines of experience. Something like, trick Mystique into giving herself away, or clocked Ultron on the jaw, and so on and so forth. This did, as the game suggested, turn into a bit of fun, a way to recount former adventures. And yes, we gradually stopped worrying about these lines and just reverted to experience points. Writing those lines on the undersized sheet was a nuisance. Durability was king. Like Ryan expressed, characters with high durability or even better regeneration function so much better in play. This got house ruled at our table as it was just too strong. We actually used the white stones for character creation, and this was helpful. One of my players in my group has been mathematically challenged when it came to point by systems. Audits of his characters in most systems would reveal he was significantly over or under points character templates. With the white stones, the physical components seemed to help. I suppose that's a trick you could use with any game if somebody has the mathematical equivalent of dyslexia, that kind of thing. Red and white stones. So at the time this came out, small glass beads were actually commonly available in game stores for use with Magic the Gathering. These were basically ubiquitous at the counters of every game store, so it was trivial to go out and get enough red and white stones. Maybe this is where the Marvel had the idea, right? I still have a Tupperware full of them, which I use for all my RPGs. The red stones are good to indicate wounded foes on a tabletop or progress points. I've got so much use out of these stones that I can't regret ever buying them for this RPG. But we stopped using them in the RPG itself after a time. Not because of the cat problems. We actively forbid cats from the table, rather because after a while it became easy to internalize what you were doing. A little scratch pad was more efficient for allocation of red energy and white health. For the GM, from day one, both myself and the other GM in the group using this system just noted down where the red energy stones were placed. After a while, because of the aforementioned gentleman's agreement, we basically didn't need to, as foes became more of a mechanical obstacle. The way we evolved our game strongly resembled some of the indie game innovations that followed. Having more static, arbitrary targets is very much the style of games today, or the static foes in Buffy or Angel and the Black Hack. I therefore see this game as sort of a middle child in indie games. Resource management RPGs that are purely manage this stat to play the game are not really my style. In fact, while we enjoyed the game, the disappointment in what we got in these books was real from almost day one. I had high hopes for about the game, and we played faithfully for about 18 to 24 months, trying to get the game to really work for us. Some of this was sunk costs, but we liked the core idea of the game, just not the execution. In time, as I picked up more games like this, Nobilis comes to mind, I began to see the core idea of points to spend each turn really did remove too much of the random fun involved in RPGs. Rolling dice is fun. Then he says, my friend went on using this game for quite some time after I'd abandoned it. He really grooved with it, but he used it more as a framework for narrative diceless play than a system, which worked for him. Myself, this game creeped dangerously away from interactive game experience and more towards Mother May I kind of play, which has the distinct disadvantage of being too tied to the GM's whims. I was working on a time travel Marvel adventure last year, which was going to start in this system. Then after a time shift, I would remove the stones and CADs and replace the player sheets with TSR Marvel Superheroes Phase Rip sheets and percentile dice. This would be followed by another time shift where sheets would be replaced again, and I would break out the deck of Marvel Saga. When I heard about the Multiverse RPG coming out, I decided to pause until that book exited playtesting. Then while I own TSR Marvel, I can borrow back my Marvel Universe RPG books from the friend aforementioned. I looked up the cost for repurchase of Marvel Saga and immediately shelved the idea. Shouldn't have got rid of it. As I recall, Mutants and Masterminds first edition hit the shelves shortly after this book came out. It was much more fun to play than this. In fact, let me acknowledge with Ryan expressed here, the actual nuts and bolts of the system weren't fun. We told fun stories with the game and had some wonderful moments, but those were all in spite of this system. And about the fact that Ultimate Marvel art was being used on the game, he says, as I recall, there was some speculation going on at the time that Marvel was going to retire the 616 universe and replace it entirely with the Ultimate Universe as the first honest-to-goodness reboot of the Marvel Universe. This ended up being false, but there was that vibe at the time. Thanks, Ian. I read it in full. I thought you made great points. You had good stories. So originally I thought, well, how am I going to edit this? I decided not to. We have Steve Race next. He says he really enjoyed listening to this one. This is not a superhero RPG I'm familiar with, he says, and now I think I know why. I thought you both did a great job of making sense of what sounds like a pretty nonsensical game. I look forward to hearing your thoughts on the new Marvel Multiverse RPG if you get around to it at some point. On a tangent, I wondered whether you have ever played Golden Heroes, a Supers RPG produced by Games Workshop in 1984. I really have not. There is a link in your topic in this episode, as when Golden Heroes was acquired from author Simon Burley, GW were trying to get the rights to produce an official Marvel RPG, and there is apparently a version of the GH rules written by Simon, which featured write-ups of the Marvel characters of the time. The license ultimately went to TSR, of course, and Golden Heroes was published as a generic game instead. It's my personal favorite superhero RPG, and it does work well when emulating Marvel Comics of the mid-80s. Anyway, I thought you might find this interesting. And he does admit that the game is now hard to find, unfortunately. It was supported a bit in White Dwarf, GW's House Magazine, and there were two scenarios published for it. It died out fairly quickly, has a great randomized character generation system, and the mechanics are quite wargamey. I would expect that from GW, yeah. But I guess that's the hallmark of the time. The author released a second edition of the game in the mid-2000s called Squadron UK, but was then quickly shut down by GW's legal position. He released a different version of the game to get around the legal issues, but it wasn't the same. Yeah, GDW games were tough to find in my area, even after we finally got a hobby store nearby, you know, in 89 or 90. So a 1984 game that didn't last would have been a big ask. But you know, Steve, I like to do research on role-playing games, so it might drop on my radar at some point. You never know. The Fire and Water Podcast Network has a Patreon page at patreon.com/FW Podcast. If you like this content, what more like it? Think about leaving a one-time or a monthly donation. It even unlocks rewards. As usual, you can leave comments about this episode at fireandwaterpodcast.com, and we'll read those comments in the next show. All right, we're done here. Let's roll.